Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, our Made in Arizona series continues with a Phoenix sculptor on public art and working with the community.
And can the Cardinals improve their 8-9 record from last year in the season that kicks off on Sunday?
But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
I've continued to post on my social media about things that are happening in the community. And this particular ethics complaint is about a post I made on August 5th when masked armed men were outside of a school in our community. And I simply reshared a post to let my followers know.
If they are not fixed like they weren't last time, then we will take him to court like we did last time. And we will beat him in court like we did last time.
My nightmare was that a maniac would invade a school, kill 20 kids, as has happened in other states and could happen here, and there's no police officer to protect the students.
There's lots of things we can fight on, believe me, there's things we'll be fighting on next year. But this was too important to come together to preserve the Arizona Diamondbacks, not just in Arizona, but in downtown Phoenix.
I've said this many times, we're not going to solve this with knee-jerk reactions. We have to do a deep dive and really look at the points where the system didn't work the way it should work.
We will keep fighting in honor of the survivors who are brave enough to put themselves out there for truth and justice, and we will not back down.
And with me to talk about an ethics complaint filed in the Arizona Senate, a vote of support for the state Republican Party chair and more, are Lorna Romero-Ferguson of Elevate Strategies. Good morning, Lorna.
Good morning.
And former congressional staffer Roy Herrera. Roy, good morning to you.
Good morning. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to both of you. So, Lorna, let me start with you. State Senator Jake Hoffman, chair of the Arizona Freedom Caucus, has filed an ethics complaint in the Senate against his colleague, Democratic Senator Annalise Ortiz. This goes back to the issue where the allegation is doxing, where Senator Ortiz reposted some information on her social media about ICE activity at a school in her community. Hoffman is asking for expulsion or other significant disciplinary action. What do you think comes out of this?
Well, I think this is just a broader issue of how heated this immigration debate has become. And, President Trump really taking action when it comes to deportations, right? We've seen this outside of Arizona when it comes to protests and people trying to actually physically stop ICE from deporting individuals, whether those are individuals who are presenting themselves, for a court hearing or whether they're at work, et cetera. And so obviously the situation in Arizona hits a little bit more closer to home, but it does present a larger issue of doxing, right? And when it comes to law enforcement, putting individuals at risk. And so does it rise to the level of an ethical complaint or breaking the law? I know this has been referred to, federal judges and whatnot.
Yeah.
I'm not an attorney. I have no idea. But there is a question of what is ethically correct for a current elected official to be doing when you're potentially putting law enforcement at risk. And so that's posing the question. Is there also politics involved? Of course. This is a huge political issue for Republicans and Democrats leading up to the 2026 election. But this is going to be an ongoing issue as long as President Trump's administration is having such a strong immigration enforcement action.
Well, so Roy, you are the attorney in the room.
Mm-hmm.
Is this doxing?
It is not doxing. I mean, doxing would be a situation where you'd be, providing to the public or sharing to the public personal information like somebody's address, like residential address or phone number or something like that. And obviously, there's a concern about doxing because I think most people, I would like to believe all people, would believe that we don't want to have our law enforcement officers be harassed. That being said, we do have a First Amendment under the U.S. Constitution, and it is very clear that Senator Ortiz's actions here are protected by the First Amendment. And just because you may not like it, you may agree with her, may disagree with her, but it's still protected by the First Amendment nonetheless. This is akin to, sharing where a speed trap might be on a highway or something like that.
Which is an analogy that she has made.
Exactly, and I think it's accurate. And at the end of the day, I find this, ethics complaint, a referral to the U.S. attorney, all to be a waste of time. And ultimately, it is all about politics. And, you have the Freedom Caucus and Hoffman trying to score political points on this immigration issue. But I ultimately don't think it's going to be successful, not only because, again, there's no grounds, there's no illegality there, but also because I do think most people in the public do believe that there should be public scrutiny and accountability when it comes to ICE's immigration enforcement actions, that that is how we are as a country. We believe in that.
Is there a difference, though, at least in this case, between legal versus illegal and whether or not it rises to violate House or Senate rules, which is essentially what an ethics complaint is alleging? There doesn't have to necessarily be illegal activity.
That's right. So that's obviously not a civil investigation or criminal investigation. This is something that would be handled within the legislature. Now, I think an expulsion, which would result in or would need a supermajority, is just not going to happen.
And he's
right?
kind of acknowledged that he probably doesn't have the votes for that, Hoffman.
Exactly. So if there's some lesser discipline, is that possible? I assume it might be possible. I think, again, it would be unfortunate because, again, Senator Ortiz's actions are protected by the First Amendment. She should have the ability to do these things. But again, it becomes a political question, I think, ultimately, with the Republicans in the legislature.
Well, so, Lorna, how do you see the politics of this issue? Because, as you say, obviously this is a big issue for both Republicans and Democrats. And it seems like in this case, you have each side kind of doing what it is that their party does, right? Like Hoffman is out there saying, you know, ICE should be able to do whatever it wants to do without any kind of interference or anything like that. And Ortiz is saying, I'm there to protect my constituents, and I was reporting on something or telling people about something that anybody walking or driving by could see. Like, does somebody come out on top on this, do you think?
I think each side will claim that they're the victor, depending on whatever happens in the ethics committee. I mean, it'll be really interesting to see how this ethics committee investigation and the hearings move forward and, you know, how Senator Ortiz handles herself and, you know, Senator Hoffman. And I know it's Senator Bullock, who's the chairman of the ethics committee.
Yeah.
How they wish to proceed. I mean, we've seen ethics committees investigations before where they turn into a circus or there's an agreement reached beforehand, et cetera. But I think either side's going to claim victory on this because, as Roy mentioned, it's not cut and dry, right, when it comes to whether someone was doxing or if this is a First Amendment issue. And all it's going to do, in all honesty, is just kind of suck up the interim at this point. And then we'll go into session and it'll be a new topic that everyone's going to deal with going into 2026. So I don't think at the end of the day it's going to play a huge issue going into the 2026 election. I just think it's something for folks to be talking about at the current moment.
But Roy, it's an interesting point Lorna makes that assuming the investigation happens and the whatever the ethics committee is going to do happens before the next legislative session, kind of a quiet time for politics, for the state legislature. Does that maybe amp up the attention on this case more so than, you know, if it were to take place, say, in January or February of next year when the legislature is in session?
It could, because it is a quiet time. And to Lorna's point, as she said a moment ago, like, immigration is obviously a hot topic. I think both sides, you know, believe that there's a way, and I'm only talking about the politics here, right, that there's a way to sort of take advantage of that. I mean, I think Democrats would say, you know, some of the actions that ICE have taken, for example, by going to, you know, standing outside of courthouses when people are trying to comply with, you know, their court orders and detaining them there, or going into schools or going into churches to detain people, are not things that most Arizonans or most Americans want to see. And so the more that happens, the more that's going to be pointed out by Democrats. And of course, Republicans, particularly like the Jake Hoffman types, are going to see it a different way and want to continue to press this. And so it wouldn't surprise me. We're going to continue to have this immigration debate, you know, throughout this quiet period, but then also even next year in an election year.
Yeah, I was going to say, it would be kind of surprising not to hear about immigration in an election year at all, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, you can already see sort of that's going to be part of the playbook on the Republican side because we're, you know, judging this by their actions related to this, even this ethics referral.
Well, in Arizona, immigration is always a top three issue, regardless of what cycle you're looking at. And so, yes, immigration and, you know, border security. And I think Republicans are going to be able to point to some significant wins, right, under the Trump administration and being able to point to how they were deported criminal illegal immigrants and whatnot. And Democrats are obviously going to talk about them going too far and criminalizing innocent individuals, et cetera. I just don't think the specific ethics complaint is going to be on mail pieces or being talked about next cycle. But the larger issue, of course, will.
Yeah.
And I do think that Republicans are going to stand strong when it comes to the support of law enforcement, making sure that elected officials of either party aren't doing anything that's going to put law enforcement at risk.
So, Lorna, let's go from an ethics complaint to a threatened lawsuit. This week, State Senate President Warren Peterson, with House Speaker Steve Montenegro sort of on board with this, threatened to sue the Secretary of State, Adrian Fontes, over potential changes to the Election Procedures Manual, which is basically the guide for how counties should be running the election, taking state law and like sort of going through the nitty gritty detail. I mean, it's worth noting that in the past, Fontes has had to change it because judges have ruled that he's gone too far. In this case, so like the comment period isn't even over, like the final version isn't even out yet. And Peterson is already saying what you're doing is not right.
Yeah, I mean, one, as you mentioned, this wouldn't be the first time that somebody has sued against, you know, the Secretary of State because of election procedure manual. I think the past few election cycles, it's become a little bit more of a political hot potato than maybe in the past. It used to be much more administrative in nature and not as many people paid attention. But yeah, Adrian Fontes has in the past put some items in the elections procedure manual that went beyond his given duties from the Arizona legislature, right? And so is Warren Peterson getting ahead of it? Of course. I think it kind of makes sense to do it before the comment period ends. Maybe there's a potential that Adrian Fontes makes those modifications. Who knows? I highly doubt it. But, I mean, it's definitely something worth talking about since Republicans are really focused so much on election integrity going into the 2026 election and making sure the Secretary of State is not overstepping, you know, his authority. So, I mean, it's not surprising. This has happened before in the past, but it's just a question of how this all plays out.
Why do you think it makes more sense for Peterson to do this now as opposed to waiting to see what's in the EPM and then maybe getting outraged about what's actually in it?
I mean, I know in the past there were complaints of that, you know, Secretary Fontes didn't give enough time during the comment period. I think that was corrected by a previous court decision and whatnot. But making it be known now and kind of putting the pressure on him early, I mean, from a political standpoint, it makes sense. Warren Peterson's running for office, right? Mm-hmm. And he's also trying to get ahead of the upcoming session where he is the current, you know, Senate president, where this is going to be an issue that his caucus is going to continue to be concerned about. And so if there's an opportunity to put public pressure right now and be able to make some changes, great, before having to file a lawsuit. Makes sense. It saves everybody money. But I mean, it's not really surprising to me that the strategy that he's taking.
Smart political move, Roy?
Well, I think it is all politics. I mean, Peterson is running for attorney general. I think it is performative to be sending, you know, not only it's one thing to be sending comments and saying we disagree because this is the comment period. And mind you, the EPM is a very complex document. It's very dense,
kind of
very
wonky.
Long. It's very wonky. It takes both the Secretary of State, the governor, and the Attorney General all to, you know, agree. There's obviously a public comment period related to this. And so it'd be one thing if Peterson was just sending in a letter to say, hey, I disagree with your interpretation here, and I'd like to see these changes before the final version. But him threatening to sue and saying that, I think, you know, Fontes is lawless, I think that was the term he used, shows to me that this is completely performative and it's all about politics because we still haven't seen the actual final version of the EPM. And the other thing that Peterson says, you know, quite frequently is like we've sued before and won. And that is true in some instances. Republicans have sued Fontes over the EPM and won, but they've also sued Fontes over the EPM and lost, right? So that's happened before. And so ultimately, if the EPM's final version is not what Peterson likes, he's going to be free to go to court and the judge is going to decide. But just because you don't like it doesn't mean it's illegal at this point. And that's what we're seeing. That might be the theme of the day, actually. Just because you don't like it, it may not be illegal.
Put that on a bumper sticker. I mean, there's nothing wrong with putting along with your concerns and comments that if these aren't rectified, you do have an intention to sue, right? I don't think there's anything new or exciting about that. And there's nothing wrong with being able to just let them know up front that, hey, take these concerns seriously, because if they're not addressed, we do intend to sue. So, I mean, I think Warren Peterson's being smart about it and letting it be known up front how concerned he is about certain provisions in the EPM.
All right. That is Lorna Romero-Ferguson. I'm also joined by Roy Herrera. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The Friday Newscap continues in just a moment. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. My guest this week, former congressional staffer Roy Herrera and Lorna Romero-Ferguson of Elevate Strategies. Lorna, let me start with you about a vote in the Maricopa County Republican Party in support of the state Republican Party chair, Gina Swoboda. She, of course, has been called on by two of the state's national Republican committee members to resign or be removed. How significant is it that the Republican Party in the biggest county in the state said, no, we think she's doing a good job?
It's incredibly significant. As we saw over the course of the past week, I think different counties were made public their letters of support for the current chairwoman, Swoboda. And I mean, the Maricopa County GOP has a tendency to sometimes be a little bit far right on some of their approaches we've seen in the past. And it just goes to show that Senator Hoffman and the folks from Turning Point, did not have the sway that they thought they did, especially when it comes to the Maricopa County GOP and them having a pretty significant vote in support of the current chairwoman. So it just goes to show that this perceived Republican infighting that we probably saw on social media and Twitter over the past few weeks didn't really garner that much grassroots support that probably some of those Turning Point folks thought.
Do you think this is in some way an indication of the power that the Turning Point folks, the Jake Hoffmans of the world, actually have within the party?
I mean, it depends. Some people might say that this was a big loss for them. Some people might say this was kind of a crapshoot. I think they kind of just threw it out into the universe to see what would happen, not necessarily thinking it would be realistic. I mean, Gina has a lot of support, and she's coming off of an election cycle where Republicans and the AZ GOP were incredibly successful during a year where Democrats thought that they were going to overtake at least one chamber at the state legislature, if not two, and pick up a number of different seats. And obviously you had, you know, the Trump-Harris battle and whatnot. Republicans were very successful in Arizona, which they had not been in a number of, you know, previous election cycles. And so building off of that win and seeing how supportive the chairwoman has been of other county parties just goes to show that her support is much deeper than Turning Point thought when they were throwing out these allegations and calls for resignation.
So, Roy, do Democrats have to stop popping the popcorn at this point?
Well, I mean, this is one of the few instances, maybe the only instance, where I was sad that Turning Point didn't have the power to do something that they wanted to do. Because, you know, I think considering the alternatives, I think Gina is probably the best at that particular job that Republicans could have, right? And so as a Democrat, I'd obviously rather see people be worse at that job. So the fact that she's still there is probably not good. I would have liked the infighting to continue. But, you know, political parties in Arizona wouldn't be, you know, political parties here unless they had that kind of infighting. And so we've seen that there. But at the end of the day, I mean, next year there's going to be obviously all the statewide offices up. To Lorna's point, the legislature will be up. And so the amount of money and effort both sides is going to be enormous. The millions and millions of dollars are going to come in. So having a party infrastructure, I think the Democrats have righted the ship there, is really important for victory next year.
Lorna, when you talk about infighting and maybe it's over, we also have to bring up the point that Jake Hoffman has sort of his slate of candidates mm-hmm. for some of these offices, where he has, for example, Superintendent of Public Instruction and Corporation Commissioners. He has sort of the Freedom Caucus Republicans going up against other Republicans, in some cases incumbent Republicans. Mm-hmm. So I wonder, like, is that really, does this really signify the end of sort of the battle between the Freedom Caucus and the rest of the state GOP?
Of course not. And this has been a longstanding issue. There's always been this underlying tension within the Republican Party of more of the far right Freedom Caucus and the candidates they support versus more of the mainstream middle of the road Republicans who tend to be more successful for statewide races, right? So yeah, there's always going to be this slate of Freedom Caucus or further right candidates. That's just been the norm in Arizona for multiple election cycles. I do think it's going to come down to, I think this is why it's so important that Gina retain her position, is because she's looking at it from a statewide perspective, right? What is best for the party at large? And how can we come off of 2024 with the wins that we had going into an election cycle, like Roy mentioned, where all of the statewide electeds are up mm-hmm. and Republicans were pummeled the last time all of the statewides were up, probably shockingly because the AZ GOP infrastructure was not as strong as it is today, right? So I think she's really going to have to focus on ignoring that noise. Maybe some of those folks are successful in a primary, maybe they're not. And then if they are trying to figure out how do you make them successful in a general election, which has always been the struggle in Arizona when some of those far right Freedom Caucus individuals have come out of the primaries, the Republican nominee.
Sure. Roy, we spoke of Secretary of State Adrian Fontes just a few moments ago. Let me go back to him because earlier this week, he rejected a request from the federal government, the Justice Department, for information on the state's voter registration list and its maintenance procedures of that. Back to some of the comments you made earlier about, you know, there are politics involved in some of these things. Is that the case here, do you think?
Well, I think his response in rejecting the request expressed some serious concerns about privacy interests, right? I mean, his concerns about the fact that, you know, this is very sensitive information he'd be providing to the DOJ and that he believes that under the law he doesn't have to provide it to them. And I think it's also important to consider why I believe DOJ is asking for this information, because I think at the end of the day, what DOJ is doing, particularly this DOJ, the Trump DOJ, is trying to continue to sort of perpetuate a myth, and that is the myth of non-citizens, or a bunch of non-citizens voting in U.S. elections. That's just not something that happens here. But nonetheless, they're still pursuing this idea because it does form the basis, I think, of continued election denialism from the 2020 election. You know, they still don't acknowledge, you know, the results of that election and believe that there's something that went wrong there. And I think this request, this type of investigation, is all part of that effort. But again, you know, the Secretary of State, I think, rightfully responded and said, hey, I really am concerned about the privacy interests. I need to know more about what you're going to do with this information, how you're going to protect it, and go from there.
Well, he also made some arguments that it might not be legal to hand over that information.
Exactly. Under the NVRA, which is federal law,
the National Voter Registration Act.
Okay, yeah, exactly. Yeah. That he wouldn't be allowed to even share it under that. And so perhaps the DOJ has a response to that, and we'll see. But again, I think it's a rightful, you know, response to have these concerns.
Lorna, you probably wouldn't have expected anything different, right?
No, of course not. But in all honesty, I do think, you know, Secretary Fontes is doing his due diligence. This is not a request that's typically made by the federal government, right? So, and this is very confidential, sensitive voter information. And so how is it going to be handled? Like Roy mentioned, what are you doing with this information? And we can't we can't forget that this is part of the broader context of what happened in the 2020 and 2022 elections, where people think that, you know, the elections were stolen from certain Republicans, et cetera. And like Roy mentioned, this ongoing belief that illegal immigrants are voting. And so, you know, I think if it was outside of that context, maybe the response from Secretary Fontes might be a little bit different. But I do think those are legitimate questions that need to be answered by the DOJ.
Roy, just about a minute left. Do you think, when Lorna talks about context, do you think Fontes was also taking into account the context of, here's a president who wants to do away with mail-in balloting and also believes that states are agents of the federal government when it comes to elections?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's the other undercurrent here. I mean, we've seen the president say that he's going to get rid of, you know, mail-in voting. That obviously, you know, 80% of Arizonans vote that way. And he doesn't have the authority to do that under, you know, any type of law. Elections are run by the states. That's in the U.S. Constitution. And so I think it's all part of that. Whether we see this eventual executive order, I don't know. I think we will see some version of it. But Fontes has been very clear in responding to that that announcement that he will fight against that, and that is not something the president will do. And if that takes going to court, that's what he's going to do. So there's a distrust here, obviously, that Fontes has with what this Trump administration is doing. And I think, again, that's you know, rightfully so, because of some of the things that the president is saying.
All right, guys, we'll have to leave it there. Roy Herrera, Lorna Romero-Ferguson, thanks you both. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. This next conversation is going to be a bit of a departure for us. It's the kind of guest we often feature on the show, someone with significant experience in an area you might not be familiar with. But this person might also sound different in conversation than what you're used to. Mateo Sanchez is a high schooler at Brophy Prep. Like a lot of high school boys, he's a big baseball fan. Mateo also has a stutter, a condition that lots of people have, but which still isn't very well understood. So, in addition to his schoolwork, Mateo recently launched a campaign to raise awareness about stuttering. And he came by our studios recently with his speech therapist, Jessica Hudson, to talk about what it's like to communicate with a stutter and how to talk to folks who have one.
I think one of the misconceptions is that I think a lot of people think, oh, the person is just anxious or they're nervous. And that's not accurate at all. Somebody who's nervous or anxious may stutter, but that's not the reason why they stutter.
Uh-huh.
That's not the original cause. One of the ways that people think about stuttering is an iceberg. The top of the iceberg is maybe what people hear, like a repetition or a block or something like that. And we can hear and see that. They don't really know the 80% that's underneath the iceberg.
So what are some of the other elements that constitute that 80% that is submerged?
I think that it depends on the person. Every single person has a different experience with stuttering, a different relationship with stuttering, different people who have said different things to them related to stuttering. And that, I think, is what can help to grow the bottom of the iceberg. Things like shame, embarrassment.
Mateo, when you began working with Jessica, what felt different about this interaction that was helpful?
We first talked when I was in first grade.
I think so. Maybe. Or kindergarten. First grade or kindergarten.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was just like so open. And that helped me see like this will help.
Got it. So like a sense of openness. That's really interesting. Mm-hmm. Jessica, I imagine that's something you're doing somewhat consciously. What are you listening for in one of those initial interactions?
Truly, one of the things I'm not listening for, which is seems very odd, is stuttering. sometimes people will come in and they'll obviously think that I'm trying to count stutters or notice stutters, and that I don't listen to the stuttering right away. My job is not to fix stuttering or to fix a person at all. They are fine just the way they are. They are great just the way they are. And maybe they need support in communication and feeling more confident. I really want to hear more about their experience and how stuttering is impacting them. So I'm listening for things like what's hard for them. Also, what's going well. Just really trying to get to know the person, not the stutter.
Mateo, would you be comfortable talking a little bit about how it felt for you to, once you started working with Jessica, to move through your life compared to what it felt like prior to when you started working together?
Yeah. I was a quiet kid and, like, talked to my classmates, but it wasn't like a conversation. It was like a quick question and answer. And currently, I'm way more talkative, probably a bit too much.
Do you get in trouble in class?
No.
That's what I help people do, get trouble in class.
Oh, yeah. So.
Yeah.
It's helped a lot.
That's great. That's great. Mm-hmm. As part of your campaign, you have shared some do's and don'ts for when you're interacting with somebody who has a stutter.
Yes.
Can you tell us what the good things to do are?
It's let the person finish talking and don't cut them off. Those are the top two.
That makes sense. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. One of the ones that I was really grateful to read that you shared was, if you're talking to somebody with a stutter, don't speak for them or assume what they're going to say.
Yes.
And that I can imagine being really valuable for people to hear, because somebody might think that they're being helpful. Mm-hmm. By assuming what you're trying to say, but you don't actually know what somebody's going to say, whether they have a stutter or not, you know?
Yes.
Well, Mateo Sanchez and Jessica Hudson, thank you both very much for coming in and talking to us about this today. Jessica is a speech-language pathologist and founder of Stuttering and Speech Therapy of Arizona. Mateo is a student at Brophy College Prep, class of 2028. If you don't want me to say what your class year is,
No. That's fine. That's fine.
Okay. All right.
Oh, yeah. Class pride. Right. Let's go.
Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Arizona Cardinals kick off their season on Sunday morning with a game in New Orleans against the Saints. The Cardinals finished last season with a record of 8-9 in third place in the NFC West, missing the playoffs. This season, if you're into these kinds of numbers, odds makers predict the Cards to win 8.5 games. But their strength of schedule would also suggest an easier time this year than last. With me now to preview the upcoming season is Josh Weinfuss of ESPN. He's a reporter covering the Cardinals. Josh, good morning. Josh, you with us?
There we go. I had you on mute. My apologies.
Ah, there we are. Hi, Josh. So what are the keys for them this year? I mean, obviously, they were just shy of 500 last year. I'm imagining they would like to do better than that this year. What are the couple biggest things they need to do to improve on last season?
Yeah, you know, there's I can imagine that your intuition's right. I think they do want to improve on their 8-9 record last year. They need to improve offensively. This offense has a lot of weapons, a lot of high-powered players, a lot of talent, but they just need to kind of put everything together. And the core of that is a relationship between the quarterback, Kyler Murray, and the wide receiver, Marvin Harrison Jr. Marvin Harrison was one of their first-round picks a year ago. He was fourth overall, came in with a lot of high expectations, and he had a good year. He had over 800 receiving yards, but if you were to ask people around the country, did he meet those expectations, they would say no. And he even said this week that last year's expectations were just sky high for him. But and there were quite a few times last year where Marvin Harris would run one way, the pass would go the other, and there's a lot of miscommunication. So in order for this offense to take the next step this year, those two are really at the core of that, and their relationship is at the core of that. So if they can get on the same page and kind of make things happen between the two of them, this offense can really take off.
I would imagine that's even more so because of the running game, which last year did pretty well for the Cardinals, and a lot of those folks are coming back again this year, right?
Yeah, they're bringing back basically the entire offensive line in some way, shape, or form. There's four starters who are expected to start on Sunday who were week one starters last year. And the one guy who is not starting this year but started last year is a backup. And the guy who's starting this year was a backup last year. So if everyone's still following along, all those guys are still back. Lots of familiar faces. The running back room is basically the same. James Conner, who's coming off of back-to-back 1,000-yard seasons, he's back. His backup is also returning in Trey Benson. So there's a lot of familiarity, a lot of guys who know this offense inside and out. It's their third year with offensive coordinator Drew Petzing. And, you know, this offensive line has been very steady and good and consistent. And I think that the Cardinals, they hope that continues in year three with everybody.
Well, how important is this season for some of those players, but also for the coaching staff who, you know, I would imagine ownership is ready for them to sort of turn that corner?
Yeah, it's huge. It's huge. I get this question actually more often than I expected to in year three. And the way I look at it is this: there was a 3-year rebuild when the Cardinals hired Coach Jonathan Gannon and GM Monty Austin-Fort back in 2023. So this is the third year of that, and the expectations that they take some significant jumps this year and get to the playoffs. You know, they were in first place in the division last year in mid-November. They won four in a row. Now, fourth game was right before their bye week. They headed into that bye and came out of it with just no energy, right? And this team kind of fell off a cliff, so to speak, and they lost. They fell into second to last place in the division. So the expectations are that they know they can get to that level again. This roster is significantly better. But when it comes to the coaching staff and the front office, if they don't reach those levels, I don't know how much it's going to fall on the coaching staff as much as the GM in the front office, because this offseason, they totally revamped and overhauled their defense, and they barely touched their offense. So if the offense struggles, that's not the coaching staff's fault. That's the front office's fault, because they didn't make those necessary changes. So it's a big year, but bigger for some than others.
Sure. So you mentioned how the Cardinals did in the division. That obviously will impact whether or not they can make the playoffs. How do the Cardinals at this moment stack up with the Rams and the Seahawks and the 49ers?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think from a roster standpoint, they are, if not at the top, the number, we're very close to the top. They have a lot of talent. They have a lot of stars, a lot of firepower. And this division truly is up for grabs right now. Obviously, we don't know what anyone looks like because no one in the division has played yet. But based on offseason moves, like, this team has a chance to make some waves in the NFC West, and they definitely have a chance to win it. Those first six games, like you mentioned in the intro, this schedule is very favorable, especially those first six games. You know, they start at New Orleans and they come home and play the Panthers, and they have a very tough week in weeks 3 and 4. It's a 4-day work week because they play the Niners and San Francisco on Sunday, and then they come home and play the Seattle Seahawks on Thursday. So two divisional games within like a 4 or 5 day stretch, and then they have two kind of easier games after that. But if they can come out of those first six games with at least 4 wins, if not 5 or 6, the season could be off to a great start for them.
And Josh, quickly before we let you go, what is the vibe been in the locker room? Like, do the players believe that they are going to be better this year than last?
Yeah, I mean, but here's the thing: everyone does, right? Everyone around the league believes at this point. You know, like there's only two teams that have a one or a loss. Everyone else is 0-0, and they all think they're winning the Super Bowl.
Right.
But I'll say this: the vibe around this team is different than it's been the last 2 years because of some of those offseason moves on the defense. They believe that this team is stacked on defense, and that the defense can really make some waves early on. And then the offense, they truly feel like they are going to take those next steps. There's a lot of expectations that Marvin Harrison Jr. is going to make some jumps from year 1 to year 2. And I think that everyone has feeling pretty good right now.
All right, we'll see how it goes. That is Josh Weinfuss, of ESPN reporter covering the Cardinals. Josh, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. And now let's meet the next maker in our series, Made in Arizona.
I could take risk with embroidery in a way that I couldn't take risk in other areas of art.
A lot of my paintings, gravity doesn't matter a whole lot.
Dance wasn't something that is necessarily seen in galleries, you know? And I just remember being like, this is the key. This is how dance gets out there.
I try to tug at people's heartstrings and try to do something disturbing.
I escaped real life and I went back in time.
Today, let's meet Bobby Zacaitis. Bobby is a sculptor who often works on a very large scale. One of his latest public art projects, titled A Time Machine Called Tanaha, features two massive sculptural arches. One is 16 feet tall, the other is 19. They look like two giant streams of water shooting up over the park with a landscaped winding path below. It's impactful. In fact, he won the U.S. Water Prize for that piece this year. And I spoke with him more about it and the community-centered approach he takes to public art.
When we are conceptualizing a project, we spend a lot of time with the community. In A Time Machine Called Tanaha, we went into the high school, Trevor G. Brown High School, and sat with every one of their art classes with a map of the site, a box of crayons, and just got their stories.
What does that look like? What did people draw, these kids?
It's kind of all over the place. We've gotten it better. We had mazes. We had stick figures. What we're doing, we're not trying to look at their drawings. Mm-hmm. We're trying to listen to their conversations.
Yeah.
And the predominant thing that we heard in that project, because you have Trevor G. Brown High School, Oso Park, and then Estrella Middle School.
Right.
And the site's right there in between the park and the middle school. And so the high schoolers were talking about the nostalgic feeling that they had when they went and picked up their kid siblings, hence a time machine.
So it's a bridge between these two places,
yeah,
in that sense. But it's also about water, right? Like this is to do with water in the desert, and it looks like water. It evokes water. When you're thinking about water and how to create something that looks like water in the desert in a sculpture that is not water, right? Where do you begin?
Well, water in the desert's mythical, right?
Yeah.
Like, so you can do anything you want. No, so the site is a water department site. It's an old water well site.
Yeah.
It's a beautification project through their office. So really, when you're trying to come up with something like that, you imagine what it flows like, what it is, but also, like, we chose arches, so there's a portal and sort of a place for the water to go, so to speak.
Yeah. You talk about wanting people to climb on the art, to touch the art, to, you know, mess around with it, right? It sounds like this is a lot about play. Like, are you evoking your own childhood in a lot of this?
Some of it. A lot of it is, well, I actually wrote my thesis on playgrounds. And actually, a lot of your playground equipment were designed by sculptors in the 50s.
Huh.
Your monkey bars, your sandbox was an architect in Holland during the rebuilding of World War II.
So this is rooted in theory and in history for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and also practicality. You know, like yeah. I can't sit in front of a computer, so I have to be in the studio welding and seeing how things go together. And
yeah. Let me stop you there because I have to ask you about that, about how you make this stuff, because you're physically making it. It's not like, you know, you're 3D printing this stuff. It's made by hand and sounds like a kind of heavy lift, right?
It's something you learn. I learned how to weld when I was 13 for a high school robotics class. And then over the years, it started out being a thing that I could do that nobody else could do. And then now it's super predominant. Some of the projects we're doing have so much welding involved. It's mind-boggling.
Yeah. So you've got a pretty large space to work in, I'm guessing.
No. I have a standalone garage and an empty lot.
Okay.
So the garage right now in the summertime, it's our ultimate fallback position. So like there's a small little air conditioner and we can do small things.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the time we are outside in the sun. We do temporary shade structures and stuff to build these things.
Yeah.
Especially like the 20 footers. Yeah.
Yeah. 20 footers is right.
Yeah.
Do you ever, after a project has been completed and it's up, do you ever go by and like watch how people interact with it? Do you ever kind of sneak that way?
Yeah, sometimes. Sometimes.
What do you see?
Well, sometimes, like I've got projects on the light rail in Tempe and they just walk by. But other times you get to see, like a dad have a special moment with a child.
Hmm.
You get to see sort of bonding over the, hey, look at that, you know, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's super cool.
Yeah. I want to ask you about something you said, because you're talking about public art and the importance of public art and the way it's used, the way it's rooted in this community or in whatever community it's going to go in. What is public art to you? What does that mean?
So there's art in the public, which there's a lot of academics. There's a lot of people who make work and display it in the public. And that there is a fine line there because you can have private money do that. With public money, you see it all the time in our area around the highways and the sound walls. I mean, in Phoenix, any piece of infrastructure that's been built in the last 50 years has a piece of artwork on it.
Right.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the role of public art in Phoenix in particular, because Phoenix is sort of surprisingly one of the leaders in public art in the country. That's why you're here, you said?
Yeah, I moved to Phoenix because I was a sculptor. I was a trained sculptor. And I was in northern Minnesota at a place called Franconia Sculpture Park. And I was playing with, we had an 8-ton boom truck we got to play with every day, a 20-ton forklift. And we were making 30, 40-foot sculptures, like 5 or 6 of them.
Wow.
Every summer. We were 15-foot sculptures, you know, 10, 12 of those every summer.
Yeah.
It was a crazy high output, but we were doing everything on a shoestring.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was 22. I needed to go to grad school. moved to the Phoenix Valley. ASU is a very good school for sculpture, and also the public art, and how established it is and how robust it is. So I certainly view the Phoenix Valley as the leader for best practices in the field.
Hmm. I wonder what you think, what difference comes from that? How do you think it makes a difference in the community having so much public art and public investment in it?
Well, there's points of pride in the community. There's also like one of the things that's been really eye-opening for me in my career is the idea of governance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right now everybody's super frustrated with the federal governance. You know, it doesn't matter what size you're on, you're frustrated with it. local governance is different, right? It's about participation, right? And so for me, like each one of my projects being tied to a piece of infrastructure, I get to see and have confidence in the water people's ability to deliver clean drinking water.
Yeah.
For 100 years.
Yeah.
You know? or like the Valley Metro to build the train.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it's allowed me insight into the rigor that these infrastructure projects go through to be able to get the funding to be able to build these things and confidence in the people who are doing that.
Yeah.
And I hope that when we do the community engagement and stuff, it's a way for community to sort of like break down that layer and start participating in their own governance.
That's really great. So there's much more to it for you. I want to ask you lastly about the idea of sculpture and going into that as a practice, as opposed to many of the artists who I've interviewed who do something much more two-dimensional, right? I mean, like, it seems like a very different type of person who is drawn to that.
Yes.
What type are you?
Well, my hobby, I go canyoneering as a hobby.
Okay.
Which is you take ropes out into the desert and you rig them and you rappel down the cliff sides in the desert. So there's like some adrenaline there, but there's also very much an understanding of what is going on, the safety procedures and the challenge.
Okay.
I would say sculptors are super interested in pushing those boundaries from like a tinkering perspective and not like a perspective of gusto like a performing artist would have.
Sure. Is there something about filling space that you like in this practice?
Well, sculpture, like big sculpture, oh, the first time you see your own work picked up by a crane, like that's a feeling.
That's cool, right? That's gotta be cool.
No, there's a magic when you go from making tabletop studies to even just 8 feet. Mm-hmm. You know, our architecture that we live within is built to 8 feet. So as soon as you get to 9 feet, you're monumental. And you're standing under a thing that you made. Yeah. And that's a really great feeling. And then it's a feedback loop of practice to work at that scale and get all of the proportions right.
All right. Bobby Zacaitis joining us. Thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, Mark, we've had quite a few monsoon storms of late, and it really feels like nothing gets an Arizonan more excited than a monsoon or a haboob, right? Like these dusty summer storms, the excited conversation they inspire, they have long been, you know, pretty unique to Arizona. But last week, the LA Times reported that climate change is making California ripe for haboobs.
Yeah, University of California researchers have even formed a consortium called UC Dust. They'll research the causes, impacts, and future of dust storms in California. They say environmental factors like how much it rains, how moist the soil is, how hot the ground is, how windy it is, they're all increasing dust emissions, meaning we can expect more dust storms across the Southwest.
Well, we have a bit of haboob advice for our neighbors to the west. Pull over if you're driving. If you're home, stay inside. And if you're outside for some reason, keep your mouth closed.
Yes. And that'll do it for this Friday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for being along. A reminder, if you've ever wanted to see the show live, you can do so, and it's coming up really soon. We're putting it on stage September 14th at Crescent Ballroom. Mark your calendar. Get your tickets at rsvp.kjzz.org. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a great rest of your day. Have a terrific weekend. Hope to have you right back here on Monday. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.